Okay, so the I'll tell you about SNCC first. SNCC was founded in April of 1960, and the way that it got founded is Ella Baker, who was at that time Miss Ella Baker, we called her Miss Baker, she was working for SCLC, Dr. King's organization, in Atlanta. And I don't know if she was a special assistant to Dr. King or what, but as the sit-ins exploded, she found a way to be in touch with all the Southern sit-in leaders, and she decided that it was important to bring them together. So she organized a conference in April of 1960 at her alma mater, which was Shaw University in Raleigh, North Carolina, and brought all the student sit-in leaders together. And of course, the NAACP was there, SCLC was there, and CORE was there. They all hoped, desperately hoped, that the students would become their student wing, their youth wing. And Miss Baker actually counseled that it would be good maybe for the students to think about remaining independent. And that was what they did. And they formed the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And it was called a coordinating committee because there were two representatives from each of the colleges that had sit-in movement activity that could put members onto this coordinating committee. And they began to meet every 2 or 3 months across the South and plan and discuss and, I guess, share tactics. And there's some books that have been written about early SNCC that I haven't picked up in a while. So, but then several months later, let's see, 60, probably the spring of 61, maybe. I'm not sure when this debate occurred, but Bob Moses, who had been a math teacher in Harlem, came south, and Miss Baker had been the organizer for the NAACP branches at one point in her history, and so she knew all these older black men, mostly men, who were in the rural areas across the South who were really, really determined to have the right to vote. And so she took Bob on a trip into Mississippi especially, and she introduced him to men like Amzie Moore and E.W. Steptoe and others who were really focused on the right to vote and hadn't, they were NAACP members, but they hadn't gotten the NAACP to really move on this voting rights agenda. So Bob came to a SNCC, he was on the SNCC staff, but he came to a SNCC meeting and he said, we've got to do voter registration. And a lot of the students, Bob was older, he was maybe eight years older, I don't know exactly.
This is the same Bob Moses who later
started. Yes, who started Algebra Project. Yeah, so he was about 8 years, because he had been a math teacher in Harlem, so he had graduated from college and he was teaching math. I don't know, about 8 years, 8 years older, maybe something like that, then, or 7 years older than other students. But the argument went, do we do direct action or do we do voter registration? And the argument went, well, voter registration is not direct action. We're not going to be confronting the system, the cops, the structures. Therefore, voter registration, and there was money on the table at the time from these different foundations, which actually was liberal democratic money being funneled through the foundations to tame the movement. So there was money on the table, and so the fear was that if SNCC went to voter registration, that it would be, the guts would be torn out of it, that it wouldn't be as militant or as radical. But the debate almost split the organization, is the way I understand it, but it was resolved that they would do both. They would do voter registration and they would do direct action organizing. So I guess this was right after the Freedom Rides, which were spring of 61. And so this was summer that the debate was held, because fall of 61 is when Bob Moses went to Macomb and organized the high school students. They walked out. They were arrested. There were big protests. And that's when Tom Hayden and Paul Potter were sending these letters to their northern supporters saying, do something, act, support us, whatever. And, you know, always you were asked to call the jails. You were asked to call your elected officials. You were asked to get local press coverage. You were hope that you could send money, that you could send. There were lots and lots of clothing drives and book drives and things like that, physical things that were sent down in trucks, you know, so there was a lot of that activity going on. And the media was played a very critical role in spreading the information about the protests and what was happening and so on. And without the media, like, for example, if you can reflect now, there's an organizing effort to save the Reed's drugstore at Lexington and Howard Street. And that drugstore was the scene of a 1955 sit-in by Morgan students. And Morgan students also sat in at the Reed's drugstore at Lock Raven and Cold Spring. The Reeds are all now Rite Aids. But anyway, I don't think that Lexington and Howard one is still there. But the one at Cold Spring and Lock Raven is a Rite Aid. All the other Rite Aids were once Reeds, R-E-A-D apostrophe S. So those sit-ins, though, were not as publicized, and so they weren't as widely understood or known or seen as an important tactic in the ongoing fight for liberation. So So anyway, the media played a really critical role in the spring of 1960, February 1, 1960 on. Once that first sit-in in February 1 of 1960 happened, there were anywhere up to 150 sit-ins across the South that occurred between February 1st and the founding of SNCC, which was April 14th, 15th, and 16th in 1960. So again, back to this debate, this direct action versus voter registration. When Bob went to Macomb in the spring of 61 and began to do the voter registration drive, it became direct action because the system reacted, the cops, the White Citizens Council, the Klan, the governors, the mayors, the county executives, they became as resistant to, you know, the freedom rides and the sit-ins as, and in fact, maybe even more resistant. So voter registration became a bigger campaign. So a bigger campaign, and also something that, in terms of adults participating in and being encouraged to go register, and people taking a stand and saying they will, you know, they will die for freedom, and they've wanted to register, but they've always been denied. I mean, it just snowballed. I mean, because I think the objective conditions were there, existed, so that the spark, which in this case was February 1, 1960, just caused an explosion of people willing to take a stand, people speaking out, people, you know, finding their voice, demanding their rights, feeling that they were somebody, that they had dignity, and they should be recognized and heard.
I'm gonna have to put you down. You've been treating me like a clown. You know you've hurt me once before. You'll never hurt me anymore.
The national media, the TV and the New York Times and so on, was a very positive portrait because the black students who went to sit in sometimes wore suits and ties. They were very respectful. The pictures plastered all over the paper showed them being beaten and being dumped on and them sitting nonviolently. So it was a very positive projection. Now, the Southern papers, it depended who you were talking about, what the Southern paper wrote. But there is actually a book, which is a great book, I understand, but I haven't read it, about the reporters who reported during the Civil Rights Movement in the South, like the Claude Sittons and the, I forget the name of it, but it's got pictures and that kind of thing. So that's an interesting, that would be an interesting thing for indie media folk to read and to understand how that media played into really supporting and helping the movement to build. And then also SNCC had a media department. It was called Communications Department, and it was a conscious effort to give information, to build relationships with reporters, which Julian Bond and Mary King, who were the two people in the communications department, did. They often met with reporters. They gave them information. They gave them access to interviews. There was a lot of that conscious work within SNCC that was going on as well.
But where were you during
this? Oh, well, during this, okay, so February 1, 1960, I was in Saratoga Springs when the first sit-ins happened, and that was when we organized the Woolworths demonstration. Then during the Freedom Rides, I was in Philadelphia working for NSA, and then that summer, I was still working for NSA, and then in the fall of 61, I was in Berkeley in graduate school. I was in African Studies. That was my choice of specialty. And that's, again, as a direct result of me meeting the African students and in through NSA and hearing about the revolutionary movements that were stirring and being very attracted to all of that. So, yeah, so then I was in Berkeley in the fall of 61 when Tom Hayden and Paul Potter sent these letters. Somewhere those letters are published. They're pretty dynamic, I'm sure. I don't have mine anymore. You know, the boxes get lost along the wayside. But yeah, so that was when I organized this student group in Berkeley, which I'll tell you about now. It was called the Provisional Committee for, it's in my story, it's called the Provisional Committee for Student Rights, something like that. And, you know, back in the day, what we did, there was a lot of tabling on campus. So you would go to, in this case, Sather Gate, which was the entrance to the Berkeley campus, and you set up a table and you had a flyer or a leaflet and you would tell people about what was happening. And then you would collect money and or you would, you know, whatever action you wanted students to take, you would have them take the action. So we sat at Sather Gate, we tabled, we had little meetings on campus. We organized the conference for the, I mean, concert for the Freedom Singers. We partnered up with some other folks, and I can't remember exactly who they were, but we had some fundraising parties in the Berkeley Hills so that we collected, you know, larger checks from people who were better off than we were as students. So we did a lot of that work through this Provisional Committee for Student Civil Rights, maybe? I don't know. It's in there. I think I only mentioned it once. But then what happened is it became part of something called the Southern Student Freedom Fund. And that Southern Student Freedom Fund, there was a young man named Walter Williams who had been expelled from Jackson State College. And so NSA put him on their staff, as I remember. I mean, some of these details may be fuzzy. And he organized all of the national student groups, NSA, SNCC, Young Christian Students, SDS, Students for Democratic Society, and there's another one, YCS, Young Christian, oh, and the Northern Student Movement, which was another organization that linked students together around issues in their own communities. So those five groups made up the Southern Student Freedom Fund, and we all began to be part of this Southern Student Freedom Fund kind of umbrella to support students in the South, and began funneling resources and doing creative things, whatever it was we could do. I mean, there were all kinds of fundraising strategies that we did, as well as the support, the Northern, what we call the Northern Support, which was, you know, calling congressmen or getting people to make statements like we had done with Governor Rockefeller, or sending supplies or raising money or whatever it was. I mean, that same sense of kind of shock and disbelief that I had when I was at Skidmore and we learned that students, black students, couldn't be served at a lunch counter, that was like mind-blowing. And then it was like, yeah, well, we can, this, the country is certainly going to, and I think I felt this all the way up through 1964 during the Atlantic City Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party challenge. And then after that, I became not so sure. And I can go into that. But the, yeah, I think we said, yes, we can do this. We had a lot of energy. It resonated with people. There were I'm sure I wasn't personally at that point in a place where there was opposition. I mean, everybody in California was like, oh, yes, this is really important. And I actually, together with another group of graduate students, well, a group of graduate students who were political science graduate students, we read the history of social movements in the U.S. So we read about, we took a book for every period of time, and we read, like, what were the ways, and of course, you know, here I had joined this socialist youth group in Philadelphia, so a lot of us were imbued with these socialist ideas too, not clear on how we were going to bring socialism about or what, but certainly thinking that it was a better system than capitalism and so on. So we read these, we had these potlucks, and California was a great place to be because, you know, you had the food, you had the radical ideas. For me, again, it's like, was mind-blowing because here I had grown up in this very sheltered, eastern, suburban community that was trying to be, and with parents who were trying to be as much a part of the system as they could be because their families had not really been part of the system, so to speak. And here I am in the middle of this social movement time and, you know, building all these relationships with lots and lots of fun people and studying these things. And so we studied social movements and we looked at every single social movement in the U.S. and we concluded several things. One is we concluded that the masses, there are two key things, that the masses, the people who were the rank and file, the people who were involved in the push for whatever rights or whatever change it was, were not, they were ready to settle for that win, whatever that was. But that the leaders had a longer vision, a further vision, and that they were ready to go on. But very often, when they won a particular victory, then they were ready to quit. So that was important to us, that, you know, you had to have a base of people who were willing to risk and willing to go further even after the initial, you know, whatever it was. If you were trying to get the right to strike, or if you were trying to get women's voting rights or whatever. So you had to have a broader, I guess we were thinking you had to have a broader analysis. You had to see how things were connected so that just winning one piece of legislation wasn't going to be where you stopped. And then the other thing that we came up with in our, you know, in our like early 1960 kind of perspectives was that the African-American struggle was the one struggle which had not been consummated or had not been realized, that there had been all of these movements. There are the Garveyites, there had been other movements within the African-American community, and they just hadn't been realized. You know, the demands hadn't been realized. And so that was the cutting edge of that moment. And that was why I quit graduate school and went south, because it was with the idea that I could really make a difference. I could be part of history. I could make a difference, even though I was just one small part of this bigger thing. But I could make a difference, and this is really what would bring change to America. So that was kind of like what we did. So that was exciting to think. And, you know, again, in retrospect, I don't think, this is so interesting. On some level, I guess I understood that I was going to be part of history. But on another level, I don't think I wasn't really that connected to that. You know, I mean, I guess it's kind of like people today. You can say that, you know, you're going to be part of making history because we're on the forefront of whatever the changes need to be. But then it doesn't really sink in until maybe 20 years later, and you're like, wow, yeah, I really was part of history there, so.
I think that's really important, not to be consumed by the fact that you're trying to make history.
Yeah, exactly. You just have to work with what you've got at that moment. But I think also one of the things to think about here is I think the United Workers, when they talk about transactional versus transformational organizing, that part of what the country has experienced, our country has experienced, is this transactional organizing. So you make a reform here, or you change a law there, or you, like, you know, you ban the box. Like, for example, last week there were a whole lot of folks who've come out of prison who went back to, and their allies went to Annapolis to ban the box, where you have to check that you've been convicted of a criminal offense. But even if the box is banned, and that's that'll be a terrific victory for the criminal justice folks, that even if that box is banned, there's so much deeper stuff around why we have so many people incarcerated, how people who have been previously incarcerated are treated, what our attitudes are toward them, what the system's attitudes are toward them, how do we create a situation where there's employment for all of those questions. So for me, the United Workers Transform... United Workers is an organization in Baltimore that works with low-wage workers. They won the living wage at Camden Yards in 2007, and now they are working at the Inner Harbor, which is kind of, I would say it's a failed development. So they talk about poverty zone development. Lots and lots of tax dollars were used at the harbor to make it a playground, and the workers are really not reaping the benefit of the development. What they talk about is transactional versus transformational organizing, and actually people around the country are beginning to talk about that. And so transactional organizing, again, would be to just fight for one law to change or one policy to change, whereas transformational would be really having people understand what the bigger picture transformation issues are, and also transforming people in the process so that they become different in their attitude toward their life and the system and their coworkers and their, you know, their work, what's important to them, and so on. What I went south to do was to be part of what was called the Northern Coordinator staff. And you see, we had the communication staff, we had a research staff, we had a photography staff, we had a print staff. This is all Jim Foreman's genius. I mean, I know this evolved over time, but this man was brilliant in terms of developing an organization with capacity. So we had, like I say, the print shop, we had the photography department, we had the communications department, we had the research department, and then we had this Northern Coordinating Department. And what we did, what our specific role was to organize resources from the North. And that meant students, reaching out to students. We planned field secretaries' trips to colleges where they would either get an honorarium or they would speak to students and they would collect money. Or we organized these Friends of SNCC groups all across the country. So every campus that we could, we had a Friends of SNCC group. Every city that we could, we had a Friends of SNCC group. And these committees actually met regularly, and they figured out how to send resources, whatever the resources would be, whether it was money or supplies. But also they were our support for calling legislators, for calling the press, for calling the jails, for whatever it was that we had to do. So a typical day for me might be answering letters from donors. Calling in the summer of 64, we called every project in the state and got information for the Watts line, which was the Watts line report, which if you look at some of the SNCC histories, there's printed examples of the Watts line reports. And it's WATS, the Wide Area Telephone Service. And they're like daily detail, you know, this church was bombed, so-and-so was arrested, everything is quiet, 10 people are going down to register this afternoon, so-and-so was released from jail, we need $500 to get somebody out, whatever it was. So then we would call all the northern groups, and I was usually the one that called the northern groups from Mississippi. call all the northern groups and give them the information from the southern projects and encourage them to, you know, see what they could do to support us in whatever way. So that would be, you know, that would kind of be a typical day, would be the communication, of writing. We used to write these long, I'll never forget this, we used to write these long mailings which would describe, you know, which would have information about what had happened, and then they would have directives about, and this, a lot of these are in the Library of Congress archives. There's some that I wrote that are there. It'll say, to the Friends of SNCC groups from Betty Garman, and then it lists what we want them to do at that point in time, type of thing. So that would have been a typical day. And then, you know, maybe going to a staff meeting, you know, that kind of thing. Doing our own calls to jails or to the FBI or to the White House or to the, you know, to the Justice Department. And again, dependent upon the specific project that we had, like during the MFDP, the intense MFDP times, we were calling, we were organizing people around the country to contact their Democratic Party delegates to take a stand to support the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party challenge. So there was that work that was done. You know, sometimes I would go out canvassing for voter registration candidates, and sometimes I would go to a mass meeting, and sometimes I would help with leafleting in the community. But more often than not, I was working in the office doing the communications stuff. So doing the support, the communication around Northern support. Well, in terms of the violence, I mean, the violence that occurred when I was in the office in Greenwood was not a big deal at all. I mean, it, for me, experiencing it, it felt like the end of the world. You know, it felt like awful. I mean, there were, I forget how many shots I thought had been fired, you know, 20 or 30, and there were actually only 4 bullet holes in the outside of the brick wall, and we were protected by 2 brick walls. We knew in advance, we'd gotten a phone call that the Klan was on their way or that these cars were on their way. But for ordinary Mississippians, the terror was, first of all, the terror went way back in history. It went back to lynching and to arbitrary murders and beatings and that kind of thing. When the Tallahatchie River was dredged during the 1964 summer looking for the bodies of the 3 civil rights workers who had disappeared, there were like 10 bodies of Mississippi black men that were found that were, you know, in the river, who had drowned, who had been thrown there and drowned. There were church bombings every week. I mean, incredible amount of church bombings, probably, I don't know, 50 or 60 or 80 a month. So there was that thing that people had to contend with. There were beatings as you went to register to vote. You didn't know what would happen. Would you be beaten? Would you be jailed? Would you be maced? Maced or tear gassed? What would happen? So the violence was intense. I mean, really intense. You know, I mean, if you think about the Egyptian, so much came flooding back into my mind during watching the Egyptian stuff, because the police and the Klan and the police were out in force across the South during these years, and so the violence was very, it was very predictable, but it was also, it could come out of nowhere. You know, you didn't know if you were driving a road between here and there, you didn't know whether you would make it. And at one point, again, due to Jim Foreman's kind of incredible organizational expertise, we had cars. He bought us a fleet of cars. He got money. I don't know who he got the money from. Maybe Belafonte or somebody. Who knows? But he went out and bought all these cars, and then we outfitted them with CB radios. So people in the back roads of Mississippi or the back roads of Alabama had a CB radio that they could there wasn't, the base stations were in the SNCC offices in those communities. Again, that was a protection, that was a defensive protection thing. So yeah, the violence was everywhere. I mean, I was less susceptible. Very seldom did I leave the black community. The one time that I went to bail somebody out of the jail in downtown Greenwood, I was bailing a black African-American guy out, and the a white man with a baby in his arms pushed me down the steps and screamed at me, "Go home, nigger lover," or something like that. So, you know, that was, again, the kind of the anger at white people. On some level, the anger at white people, well, the anger at white people, let's say it was different. It wasn't worse, I wouldn't say. It was different because you were seen as a race traitor. The anger at African Americans was, what's wrong with them? They're too uppity. What's wrong with them? Why aren't they the docile people that we imagined that they should be, or that we expected they should be? So there were those two kind of pictures of it. But again, you didn't know where that violence was going to come from. It could be very arbitrary. I mean, no, I don't mean arbitrary in the sense of not targeted, but it could happen at any moment. So,
and is that partially why you stayed most of your time within the African American community?
Well, I think for most SNCC workers, yes, that was what we did. I mean, we didn't. Well, first of all, there was no reason to go into the white part of town unless we were demonstrating. I mean, we weren't going to go buy at white stores or socialize with the white people there. So, and our work was in the black community. So we did. That was kind of where our focus was. As far as white women or white people, there was also like danger if you were riding in a car, an interracial car. So often the white people would be on the floor in the back, covered over by a blanket, or the black people would be in the back, covered over by a blanket, and if the white people were driving. So that's kind of how you lived your life. You know, you knew where it was dangerous to go or not in a car, what back roads were safe, what back roads were not. But also, again, you never knew. I mean, you know, people were very careful about the routes that they took. They were careful to vary their patterns, that kind of thing, so that there wouldn't be any, you know, easy way for the opposition to gun you down or arrest you or whatever.
And how long were you in Mississippi?
I was personally in Mississippi just June, July, and August, 3 months. And then I went back to Atlanta. And the same kind of thing in Atlanta, except because it was a big city, the black community was much larger. I definitely lived in the black community in an apartment with other SNCC workers. And the threat of violence wasn't as enormous, unless, again, there was a demonstration. There weren't too many church bombings in the big cities, although, of course, the 16th Street Baptist Church was bombed in Birmingham, but it wasn't the same. The rural areas were just much more dangerous, and that's also where the denial of rights and the repression and the violence, the lynching, all of that was much more common.